What just happened? Please tell me nobody kissed me.
We won.
All right, hey. All right, good job, guys. Let's just not come in tomorrow. Let's just take a day. You ever tried shawarma? There's a shawarma joint about 2 blocks from here. I don't know what it is, but I want to try it.
We're not finished yet.
And then shawarma after.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today we are here to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the AvengersAssembled.net website, which I started as a college student way back in 1995 at Auburn University. And here to discuss that momentous occasion with me are two longtime friends who have been associated with that site and the mailing list that sprang from it almost from the beginning, Kel Carpenter and David Wright. Welcome aboard the show, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Beginning in alphabetical order, I guess, Kel, introduce yourself to our listeners.
Sure. I'm Kel Carpenter. I'm the Associate Director for Access Services at Georgia College and State University in beautiful Milledgeville, Georgia. Been part of the group since around the start. Got in through the back door through fan fiction, and then I was too awesome not to be a part of everything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the two of you, actually, it's interesting that we ended up getting the two of you guys on here to talk about this. I'm going to throw it to you, David, in just a second, but I kind of want to roll this into your introduction, David, that you two guys both kind of came in a little after the beginning, but through a specific venue. So we'll talk about that in a second. David, introduce yourself to, although you, this is like your third appearance, so the listeners have heard you before.
Sure. Well, I am a video producer. I live in Columbus, Georgia. It's where it's my hometown. I've spent a lot of years in Birmingham, but I have been an Avengers fan my entire life. And the I was just figuring out that there was a World Wide Web beyond AOL sometime around 97 or 98. And being a lifelong Avengers fan, I went searching for websites. And your website was there. It was one of the first ones up on the web, and it was full of information. It was just it was just really good to see such a site full of what's clearly a lot of deep fan knowledge, a lot of appreciation for the history of the series. It was an exciting time for the Avengers because they were just getting rid of the whole Rob Liefeld experiment. And returning with Kurt Busiek and George Perez. And so I was full of excitement for the series, and I found this website. And as I started clicking around, I found out that you, Van, were actually from a town near where I lived and had actually attended university at Auburn, where I was in Columbus, and you were actually coming into Columbus and going to the same comic book store.
That's right.
That I grew up going to. So I immediately felt like I could get to know this guy. So I just contacted you through the website and just kind of found the group through you. I think I met you at Dragon Con one year with a bunch of guys.
Yeah.
And I was never really a part of, I think, the first year or so of the mailing list, but then. Y'all were kind enough to invite me in, and I think I officially joined your group sometime in early 99, and it's just been great hanging out with y'all ever since.
Yeah, I that's what I was getting to a minute ago, is I think of you two guys, when I think of how I met you, I kind of associate you two almost together, just because we both we all three kind of met in person for the first time, I guess, at the 99 Dragon Con.
It was actually it was actually 98.
Was it
98?
Yeah. See, I always get those years mixed up, because 98 was like my first one back after a couple of years, and I didn't do a whole lot at the 98 Dragon Con. So
98 was Kurt Busiek was our guest.
Yeah, the dinner.
Wow. Okay.
And I was actually at that dinner before I was ever a member of the Jarvis Heads.
Mm-hmm.
But same here.
But and then in 99 was it moved from Labor Day to June or July.
July 4th weekend, yeah.
And that's when we saw George Perez there.
Yeah, we're going to get into that for sure. Okay, let me give quickly a little rundown of how it all came about, and then we'll kind of get into, for those listeners that are curious what we're going to be talking about, I'm going to talk a little bit about the website, but mostly we're going to talk about the Avengers, because that's the reason that we all have been associated with it and with the various, the mailing lists and so forth over the years, is the Avengers. So we're going to talk about the greatest stories and our favorite characters and all that kind of stuff in just a couple of minutes. But the reason this is a thing, the reason we're having an anniversary of something, is because what happened was in September of 1995, I was a graduate student at Auburn in the history department. And my roommate was a friend I had known for several years who worked at University Computing, the Division of University Computing at Auburn. And he started teaching me HTML, how to write your own very basic web pages. I had never done anything but send a couple of emails through Pine. That was back even before Outlook. It was back before any kind of, you know, email systems really were available, other than just, you know, the very, you know, like a black screen with green letters, you know. And he was this was in the day of Windows 3, you know, when it was very primitive and your browser was Netscape Navigator was the only thing there was. And he was teaching me how to do that. And we said, let's make up web pages. These are these new things that people are starting to do now just recently. And so he did a Nexus web page based on Mike Barron and Steve Rude's comic that I had introduced him to. And I said, well, I'm going to do the Avengers. And so I set up Avengers Assemble website. And what was amazing was I just stuck it out there, didn't have any kind of, you know, way that it would pop up in search engines. In fact, the big search engine of that day, do you remember, it was Alta Vista.
Oh, yeah.
There was no Google yet. It was very difficult to find anything on the web. People nowadays don't understand what a revolution and revelation Google has been, because, you know, it actually finds things you're looking for and does it quickly. Until Google, you were really, you know, Yahoo and Alta Vista and everything, you were really desperate. They returned very bad results.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So somehow, within about a week of setting up that Avengers page, where I just, you know, he and I scanned some comics, you know, some images like the logos and all that kind of stuff, and we put it out there. And within about a week, I got an email from a guy named Vince Alvarez, who said, I just happened to find your Avengers website. It seems really cool. So we started emailing about it. And then I got an email, I think, from Sean McQuaid.
Oh, yeah.
And if those of you out there that have read the Assembled books will start knowing these names, and plus David and Kel. And then I got an email from Lad Everett. And so
This is the founders.
It really was. And the four of us were emailing each other. And so I had just recently been introduced to Bobby Polite by way of John Queering. Since, again, the listeners, most of you won't know who these people are, but if you read my Sentinels books, you know the name Bobby Polite. He's my co-plotter on the Sentinels books. And Bobby was a huge Avengers fan, and he worked for a computer company in Atlanta. He said, well, let's set up a mailing list so the five of us can talk about the Avengers. And that's really where it all started. And so in 95, I set up the webpage, and by 96, Bobby was setting up this very primitive, early, you know, version of what is today a Yahoo group. And it just started growing and growing and growing. And you guys came in pretty early, along with people like David Medinas and Mark Ballou and Mark Busquet and quite a few others. Lonnie Holland came in pretty early. I'm leaving out a bajillion. Scott Harris and who, you know.
Mike Proctor
early on, yeah. And so quite a nice little group built up. And we just talked about the Avengers pretty much for a long time. Now, the funny thing is, for the most part, that group is still together today online, but we rarely talk about the Avengers anymore. We've been together for 19 years on the internet, and 20 when you count the web page. It's pretty remarkable.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So, like you guys were saying a minute ago, one of the first things we did was to begin to meet each other in person at Dragon Con, because that was kind of a central hub that a number of us, at least in the Southeast and a few others, could get to. And because I know, you know, Vince has lived in Florida and he's lived in Colorado, but he's come a couple of times. George Kopech, David Medinas.
John Warren.
John Warren, absolutely. Yeah. Don't forget Warren Head.
Scott Beatty.
Yep. So quite a nice little group. Proctor came early on. And so we had a nice little group there. Like you said, we got to meet and get to know Kurt Busiek and then George Perez. And over the years, we've gotten to know other professionals in the field. It's amazing how that, you know, me sitting down at the computer in Auburn and saying, I'm going to make a web page, doing air quotes, with these pictures of the A logo and some superheroes, turned into that. It's funny how these things start so primitive and just snowball. But
yeah, at various points along the history, we've had, as members of the group, you know, Jim Salicrup, Roger Stern, Steve Englehart, Steve Gerber for a little while. Mm. There was Bob Allman and Tom Smith and Fabian Nicieza,
mm-hmm,
and Tom Brevoort. So it was an exciting time there, the early days of Volume 3 of the Avengers. And it felt like I had some kind of inside track, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was before Facebook or social media had exploded. And we had this kind of like private dialogue with these comic professionals and fellow lifelong fans that we could actually, you know, have conversations with about the trivia of Avengers history. And, you know, I've spent my whole life knowing all this stuff, but having nobody to talk to about it. And so it's been an exciting time.
Yeah. So that's the history, basically. Now let's dig into the Avengers themselves a little bit. Cause I mean, that's the thing that drew us all in and drew us together. And I think when we celebrate, you know, 20 years of the Avengers Assemble net site, what we're really celebrating is 20 years of us all kind of knowing each other and having a central hub to congregate around that became the mailing list. And it was all about the Avengers and becoming, you know, sort of lifelong friends out of that. So what is it? I want to, Kel, you tell us first, what is it about the Avengers as a concept or a comic book or the characters or what that kind of drew you to them originally over other things?
It's the team, yeah, that team dynamic. Some of the earliest things I remember are from the 70s with when Byrne was doing the artwork, and I'm guessing it was, gosh, I have such a hard time remembering the writers from early days when I was reading, but, you know, it seems like it might have been the Englehart stuff or the later Englehart, earlier, maybe some Roger Stern stuff, I don't know.
Shooter in there too, probably.
Shooter was in there too, but it's just the drama was there. There was that tension of, gosh, what could happen? Somebody's going to die, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's going to be this epic adventure, and all these characters are in one place. It was like a one-stop shop for everything. As a kid, you know, it's more bang for your 35 cents or whatever.
That's right.
Oh, wow, that's a long time ago.
I missed still only 35 cents.
Yeah.
Now it's still only this month's mortgage.
Yeah, really. but you know, and that's just it. I mean, you see all this dynamic, and it's fun to see how when they did it well, they kind of touched on, had a little thread that attached to each of the individuals in those comics. You know, you pick up Cap and you see a reference to an Avengers adventure, and oh yeah, I've got that one. And you read them together, and oh my God, they're connected, and it's just this great, wow, this is this epic universe. I think that was it for me.
Mm-hmm. What about you, David?
Well, I discovered them in the very early 80s. It was probably around 1981 or so. I remember that my first issue was issue 211,
mm-hmm,
which maybe for a lot of people is not that special of an issue, but it was my first one. And to me, it was significant because that was an issue where you had the old order changeth.
Yeah.
Gene Colan was the artist. This was Jim Shooter's return to the book. This was issue one of the second Jim Shooter run.
Mm.
And And it started with Vision, Scarlet Witch, Beast, Wonder Man, all members of the group on the front page there. And by the end of the issue, they were all gone, and a whole new lineup was brought in, but it was basically the old lineup. It was a return to the founding lineup, but with the addition of Tigra. And so I felt like I had jumped on at the perfect point. Ground floor, they're wiping the slate clean, they're starting over, and this was exciting. It did a couple things. Number one, I already knew who Captain America was and Iron Man was. And the Avengers felt important because there were all these other books in Marvel line, you know, all these solo books, but it was like those were just spinoffs. It felt like the Avengers was the hub that was driving all these other books that Marvel was publishing. And at the same time, it gave me a sense of history. Like, who are these characters that just left these early scenes? Who are these people? What else happened in the first 210 issues? So that issue kind of motivated me both to buy more as it came out. I quickly subscribed to the series. I remember by the time I was going to the grocery store or the convenience store to buy the next few, I had placed my subscription order, and the first one to come in the mail to me was the one, I think, issue 225 with Black Knight on the cover. But at the same time, I was equally motivated to start looking for the earlier issues to find out everything I had missed. And so you didn't have eBay or anything like that. And right there, when I first started, I didn't have a comic book store I could go to, although I did find one quickly after that. But starting looking through the back issue bins and going to flea markets and stuff, and anytime I could find an issue I didn't have, it was just a thrill. One thing that I really like that I miss in modern comics is that you're reading a story and you're having fun with it, and then there's a little asterisk. And at the bottom of the panel, it says, as seen in the Nell Classic issue, 109 or whatever. Yeah. I was like, that drove me crazy. I had to have issue 109. It was classic. It said so right there.
There you go.
So it, I just, it, from the, just, it, the Avengers was the driving comic for me. It's what kept me buying comics for so many years. And it was the shared history. It was the dynamic, the interplay between the personalities. It was the connections, the family history between, Pym and Vision and Ultron and Wonder Man and Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch and all the connections that you can get there. It's just, the X-Men never really appealed to me. The Fantastic Four was okay, but the static and limited lineup of that team just kind of didn't have the same appeal for me. It's always been about the Avengers.
Yeah, I guess about second grade, I had my emergency TV show lunchbox, and some other kid had a Marvel Superheroes lunchbox.
I think I'm probably thinking of exactly the same one.
I had it. Jim Starlin did the artwork on a lot of it.
Oh man, I didn't realize that. I didn't realize it until later.
My parents still have it at their house. And I went and looked at it and said, oh my God, that's Jim Starlin art. Oh my God.
I didn't know that. It's got like different characters, at least the one I'm talking about, like separate, individual, like three are on the front, three on the back, and different ones around the sides. Well, I remember looking at it and there was Thor was kind of big and, the Fantastic Four probably on it. I don't even remember. Spider-Man's on it pretty big. But I remember like on the side or probably the bottom was Iron Man.
Yep.
And I remember all the others. I'm like, okay, there's a guy with a hammer, and there's a Spider-Man. I've heard of him and all that. And I looked at Iron Man. I had never heard of Iron Man. I knew nothing about him. And I kept looking at that picture, and I'm like, it's like this guy made out of iron. And I was like, is he a guy made out of iron? Is there a guy in a suit? What is he, like a knight, or is he like a statue, like a like a metal man? Because I'd seen the Sinbad movies with the weird Harryhausen monsters and metal guys and skeletons and all. So I didn't know what he was. And I was like, it looks like he's flying. So he's a metal guy, but he's heavy, but he can fly. This totally intrigues me. I must know more about this character. And so that was how I got all into Iron Man. I'm trying to think. So my first actual comic, my first Marvel comic was Avengers 162. And man, what a place to come in. It was very early in the Jim Shooter, George Perez run. And it was The Bride of Ultron. And my old copy is still around here. It's pretty battered and beaten, and the cover's gone. But I've got my replacement copy I got several years later that I'll be taking to see Avengers Age of Ultron. I'll have it as my little talisman there in the theater.
Yep.
Some of you know, by the way, as a quick aside, that I when we were going to see Avengers, we're going to talk about the movie and everything toward the end in a minute. But when I first went to see Avengers, the movie, I had started the tradition with Fellowship of the Ring of taking a talisman with me to make the movie be good. Yeah. And I took my original Fellowship of the Ring copy to Lord of the Rings, and it worked.
Yes.
So I was.
Thank you for that, man.
Yeah, yeah. You're welcome. So as I was trying to get out the door, and the family was getting in the car, and we didn't want to be late to see Avengers the first time, I was trying to find my copy of 162 because that was my first. And I knew Ultron wasn't in it, but I just wanted my first comic, and I couldn't find it. And so I grabbed the other one that I had early on, which was Avengers Annual number 7 with Thanos. Well, didn't that work out?
Yeah.
That's a good move.
But about a week ago, I found my backup copy of 162. So now I have it as my talisman for Age of Ultron. So it all worked out perfectly. I just never, excellent. You know.
Excellent.
But yeah, my first Avengers comic, 162, and Jim Shooter, George Perez, the first run. I mean, how could you not become a huge fan? And I had... I think I had read a Justice League annual or something a few months earlier and just didn't like it that much. It was kind of corny, and the characters just didn't compel me. They weren't very exciting. The Avengers seemed more grown up. It seemed more serious. It seemed more deadly. They took that. It was like reading a science fiction novel or a serious sci-fi movie. But in a comic book, you know, it shaped me in so many ways in terms of like how I write the Sentinels and everything, in the sense that it made me think of superheroes not as da 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 caped guys flying around, but as science fiction characters in a gripping serious drama. It changed my way of thinking of them forever that way. And then right after that, I found Marvel 2-in-1 Annual number 2, and then I went back and found Avengers Annual number 7, and that was Jim Starlin doing a completely different take on the Avengers. Man, this was all happening, by the way, in around the summer of 1977, just as Star Wars was coming out.
Yep.
So what an amazing year 1977 was, if you like the kind of stuff that we like.
I mean, and what a way to be introduced to the series. I mean, you were only seeing the most amazing stuff ever. And kind of spoiled for life with all that stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I quickly was able to go back and get most of the issues to 158, which is where Shooter came in. And then I kind of went forward from there. And so I consider that run, which we'll talk about in a minute as far as favorite storylines and everything, just the most amazing. And then between that and the Starlin Thanos thing, I mean, you know, how could I not, you know, just become totally devoted to the Avengers for life, basically?
Right.
Well, tell me this. I said kind of my reaction to Justice League. So based on what you guys were saying, how come we're not all huge Justice League of America fans?
Well, I mean, in my own way, I do love Justice League. But I think what you're saying, though, is up to that point, everybody in America knew comics, and it sort of hinged off, and it's the tone was sort of set by what had been on Batman 66.
Mm.
Oh, it's campy. It's comic books. Of course it's campy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Batman went from being this really dark kind of detective to being reflected on what was on the screen, which was not true to the original creation of Batman. And I think a lot of what DC did, and I think, unfortunately, that's still true today with DC, they're not able to kind of break the mold. They want to play off of what is popular to the general public, whether it's valid or not, and whether it's good or not. And I think with the Avengers and with Marvel in general, they were not hamstrung by that. They didn't have that, oh gosh, we've got to make this what it is on TV because that's making us a bunch of money. Hmm. It was good for the sake of being good. And I think that has played out again in real life in the movies with Marvel's just crazy ability to say, hey, we're going to make what people love, and you'll see that it's going to bring in money.
Yeah. Developing during the 60s didn't hurt Marvel, because I think it gave it a little more of a down to earth modern sensibility than what you see at DC. Go ahead, David.
Well, before I get into the answer I was going to give, your last point there, I mean, it made me think of that. Yeah, they developed in the 60s, and DC was full of guys, you know, from the 30s and 40s
mm-hmm.
that were trying to figure out what kids these days wanted in the 1960s. And so, and what they did very well, but they were definitely aiming for a younger crowd than what Marvel was going for.
Yeah, it's always seemed like it, yeah.
And so, even when I came on in the early 80s, I still, at that point, still had this sense that Marvel was taking things a little bit more seriously. Even though it might be some crazy, whacked out cosmic stories or whatever, they weren't writing down to their audience. Mm-hmm. You know, they were kind of challenging, you know, to me, it made me a better reader. It opened up, it opened me up to other concepts. It drove me to read. I was a young reader as far as reading, you know, big serious novels when I was still in grade school, kind of thing. I grew up with the Super Friends cartoon. If it wasn't for the Super Friends cartoon, I probably never would have bought a comic in my life, and we all never would have met.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up just, I had to have, you know, was 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock Saturday morning, I had to have my bowl of Apple Jacks, and I didn't want to miss the opening theme song, you know, and it was, I enjoyed it. It was a blast. It was awesome. I enjoyed the superhero team. Well, so friends at school I'm in fourth grade or so, friends are introducing me to comics. I pick up a Justice League comic, and I don't recognize it. It's not the Super Friends.
Right.
There's a bunch of other characters in there that I don't know. You know, I know the big six, the big seven, you know, and who are these guys? It was just like, I'm confused. I don't want that. But I knew who Captain America was, and here I was reading issue 211, my first experience of the Avengers, and it's like, here's all these guys you don't know. We're getting rid of them, and we're just going to introduce – we're starting over just for you, David. And so I was able to I had a good introductory issue, and so I just went with the Avengers. And whenever I did, like, check in on what was going on with Justice League, it was still full of people that I just didn't recognize and didn't care about. And they didn't really return to that iconic lineup in Justice League until, I think, the late 90s. So, you know, that's why I guess I'm an Avengers fan, not a Justice League fan.
Well, and you know, I guess, too, the thing with the Avengers is they were never afraid to go back to that old order changeth idea.
Mm-hmm.
Back, you know, from when Cap's Kooky Quartet... You know, yes. it's this group of, wait, this isn't the Avengers. What's going on? Even up into the 70s with Henry Peter Gyrick, there's only room for X number of Avengers, you know, that kind mm-hmm. of thing on the cover. Bam. It's just this idea of we've got all these people, but they come in, they come out, and it makes for this great flow and this great tapestry that you can tell all these wonderful stories with.
And can I also say this? The Avengers started off with about 25 years of just solid writing.
Yeah.
I would say the first 300 issues, although there's some inventory issues here and there's some short runs of, you know, mediocre issues. For the large part, you had Stan Lee, Roy Thomas,
yep.
Steve Englehart, Jim Shooter,
mm-hmm.
David Michelinie, Roger Stern, Kurt Busiek. Some people started Roger Stern. There's parts of the early Bob Harris run that I like. I'm famous for defending that. That's not totally popular with people.
Yeah.
But all the way up through Roger Stern, I mean, you stop at Roger Stern, the comic's 25 years old at that point, and there's only been a handful of writers.
Yeah.
And especially with the Roy Thomas issues, it was at the very hub of the entire Marvel Universe and mm-hmm. kind of driving everything that was happening. So there was it just felt it felt deeper, and it felt like there was more of a commitment from the writers. And I'm checking in with Justice League, and it was just episodic, you know, real light stuff. You know, maybe I have a bad impression of it. Maybe I'm totally wrong about that. But it never impressed me. It never hooked me.
But, you know, you talk about Super Friends. I watched it religiously as a kid, but I never really liked it. It was like almost every other superhero thing of the 70s and early 80s era to me, which is you watched it because it was what you had, but you were always kind of disappointed. You know, I mean, like, I watched Wonder Woman. I watched the old Superman 1950s show, the black and white show. I watched the Hulk show. I watched the Super Friends. And they all just left me going, you know, where are the supervillains? You know, I've always said we really didn't get actual supervillains in any kind of TV or movie property until probably Superman 2 in 82. Yeah. And I mean, that's a long time other than in the cartoons. I mean, I know the Super Friends had, you know, they had, but here was the funny thing about the Super Friends. Like the first season of Super Friends, they really didn't fight supervillains either.
No.
They didn't even bring in the Legion of Doom until like the second or third season. Like the first year of Super Friends, they would fight like a robot or, you know, a Godzilla type creature.
Or the leftovers from Scooby Doo.
Yeah.
We would have got away with it if it wasn't for you superheroes.
Yeah. Even as a 6 year old, I knew that Marvin and Wendy and Wonder Dog were kind of lame.
Kind of lame, yeah.
But then, you know, later on, now I'm in third or fourth grade, and they've got the Legion of Doom with all the bad guys. Everybody's arch enemy is there teaming up, you know.
But you know, I wonder
living in Darth Vader's helmet.
Yeah, that's right.
I wonder though if some of that blandness with the villains is sort of the residual effects of the comics code. You know,
maybe so,
or perhaps just the old guys in charge when DC was, you know,
yeah, these kids they need some kid characters and a dog to identify with. Right. They can't identify with the heroes, and they're not going to understand supervillains. They need like a monster or a robot or something. So,
and they always have to win. The villains can't be scary because villains are never scary. That's awful.
See, that always felt insulting to me, and that's one of the reasons that I ran to Marvel, and it's one of the reasons why, like I said, Avengers 162 was such a revelation, because it didn't talk down to me. It was serious. There were no kids running around being goofy. You know, it was like it really was like a big time, like a comic version of a big time modern, you know, movie of some kind or something. Real serious drama. And I could never get people as a kid, when I was a kid, to understand that. They'd see me reading like Avengers or something, and they would think, oh, some goofy comic book. I'm like, you need to read this. It's not like that. But, you know, you could never get people to understand that back then. I think now people, I think, understand it a little better because comics have changed so much over the years, which we'll talk about as we go toward the end as far as kind of how we feel about things now. But
the tone of something like, you know, Avengers Annual 7 or, or the Marvel 2-1 Annual is the tone of that compared to the Adam West Batman TV show.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, it's like
it's unbelievable.
People just for decades would just categorize all comics into like one little niche in their mind.
Yep.
And it's like you really don't know what you're missing. This is actually pretty cool.
Yeah, I've always said that the Adam West Batman show, for all that there's charm about it, it did more harm to superheroes in the public view than any other single thing. And I mean, you know, I've got friends like Jim Beard is a huge devoted fan of that show. He's written books about it. He loves it. And that's awesome. I get that it's a charming thing. It's fun. It's neat. But that's if you know what you're dealing with going in. If you're just an average person and you watch the old Batman show, you immediately think all superhero stories must be incredibly stupid and lame and want nothing more to do with them except as jokes, you know. And so,
well, you know, I think it's still doing damage because I think the total lack of humor in DC's movies today.
Oh, it's a direct, yes.
It's
yes,
a direct reaction. Really, we're not like that, I promise.
I think you're exactly right. And they carried it too far because, not to go too far afield here, but yeah, I mean, it's kind of like DC has always been the happy-go-lucky comic superhero universe, and Marvel is a little more darker and realistic and grim. And then DC has just gone to the other extreme. It's almost like they flipped from light to dark. They've gone and said, we need to get as far away from who we are. In other words, you know, they've gone from hot to cold, whereas Marvel was always kind of in the middle, so they didn't have to move at all. And so that means the Marvel movies are very, very close to the Marvel comics the way they've always been, whereas DC's movies are nothing like.
No.
Nothing like the history of their comics.
Well, and you know, with Marvel, and even more so now with Disney being in the picture, it just means they've got more money to throw at their stuff to make it better. But with them in charge of what they're putting out, you know, for the first time in their history, really, on a big scale with the movies, they can do what they want to do. And they have a good gauge of what their readers and what their fans want to see translated to the screen. And I think it says a lot, and I guess we can get more into it when we're talking directly about the movies. But for me, it's the idea that they get that I am going to be excited about seeing whatever it is, even if it's not what I read as a kid. It's so close, and it's got that same feel that I'm okay with it. As opposed to DC, well, we tried this and it was dark, and people paid a bunch of money to see it, so everything must be dark. Everything has to be dark. And in our comics, characters can't be happy. They can't be married. No, they can't do that. I mean, I don't understand. I don't know.
And you can do that with Batman to a degree, but Superman has no business being like Batman. That just
he's happy and shiny. I mean,
that's his appeal is that he's the all-American Boy Scout. I've always said Superman's greatest power is not that he can fly or that he's really strong. Superman's greatest power is that he's got all those abilities and he's still a good guy.
Yeah,
that's true.
Well, that's all well and good. Let's talk about let's start with this. I've already said, I kind of introduced that my favorite Avenger is Iron Man because of the lunchbox. and then I was actually in Florida that summer and found Iron Man number 96 on a spinner rack in the hotel gift shop. And I remember thinking, and the art wasn't as good. That was more of I think it was Carmine Infantino, whose art I've never really appreciated on superheroes. I think Infantino's good on something like The Flash or Nova that conveys motion, and he did both those books. But just for like a more static superhero, he's not, and he sure don't want him on Star Wars like he did for a while. But that was the early Mantlow Iron Man, and it was him fighting Ultimo in Washington D.C. and I loved it. I think it was early Mantlow. And I remember thinking, whoa, he has his own comic book in addition to being in the Avengers. How cool is that? And so I became the world's biggest, to some degree, Iron Man fan, which is my great joy and curse that he became the world's most popular superhero. I can't believe I'm saying that. When I was in my 30s and 40s, I'd have had all these toys. You couldn't get an Iron Man toy when I was when I was a kid. But anyway, I digress. So, David, who is your favorite Avenger and why?
Well, I have four that are always at the top of my list, and two of those are Captain America and Iron Man. I've always liked Captain America. He's just kind of the iconic leader of the Avengers. Mm-hmm. I like Iron Man because he's a cool character. Like, you know, when I discovered the issues of his that I discovered first were the ones right around the time that Rhodey was getting ready to take over, and in the early 80s. And
you just missed the good stuff.
I had just missed the good stuff. I had come in with the Denny O'Neill and
Luke. Oh God, I'm sorry.
Which I'm very fond of, and I will defend it. But
I get it. I get it.
Obviously, there was a. I have gone back and gotten all the McLean and Layton stuff, so it's pretty awesome stuff. Anyway, I love Hawkeye. I'm a huge Hawkeye fan. He's his kind of personality and attitude that he would bring. He's kind of like the snark, you know, that kind of just cuts across all the superhero, you know, people taking themselves too seriously. He comes in and kind of has the smart aleck attitude to kind of deflate everybody, which is always kind of fun. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have superheroes. He was just unafraid of anything. And he'd take on, you know, Galactus with his bow and arrow, you know, and somehow find a way to win.
It's true.
It's the ultimate nullifier era.
Or, you know, elders of the universe, right? One of the elders of the universe, the Collector, has captured all these huge.
Oh, monsters. Yeah.
Yeah. He comes swinging in on a rope and like fires an arrow and, you know, saves the universe.
174. Yep.
So, I always liked what he brought, just what his personality, when he's written well, he's a very, very fun character. And it's, you know, so I'd probably put Hawkeye there, but I have a pet character, you know, a lot of people have pet characters where they're kind of obscure. They don't get a lot of storylines. People go, what, why do you like that guy? Well, my pet character is the Black Knight. I've just always loved the Black Knight. Okay. I guess I like knights in shining armor and King Arthur stuff and all that kind of stuff. And I've always felt like that the Black Knight and the Avengers has a lot of I think he has enough there to support a solo series, except for fans. If he just had the fans, because he's got the history, he's got all the connections, and he's fought in different time periods. And I don't know. I like the Black Knight. Call me a Black Knight fan.
Cool.
All right, Kel.
I also have multiple favorites. Of course, Captain America is a favorite. In general, and the Vision has always been someone that I really have just enjoyed. I was devastated when John Byrne turned him into a walking toaster.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it was one of those things that just I couldn't describe it. And like you, Van, the Vision was on the lunchbox. And I enjoyed him for that. And I also enjoyed Yellowjacket for that, who has quite the colorful and I guess now infamous history moving forward from the shooter era. But my favorite of all time is another one of those characters that people say, it's a what? Is Wonder Man.
Mm-hmm.
I love that my first exposure to Wonder Man was the field jacket era, the red field jacket, the belt jets, and the shades. I first remember him from a Marvel 2-in-1 where he was part of a poker game that involved Ms. Marvel, Nick Fury, The Thing, and there's somebody else.
The great poker players of the Marvel Universe. Yes. That's them.
Yes. And I remember...
The Beast, maybe?
Yeah, it was The Beast. It was The Beast, because he made a joke about gyros on The Thing about being Greek sandwiches. Yeah. But the thing that got me with him initially was Ben is saying, hey, how come Shades gets to wear his cheaters? And he says, okay, I'll take them off. And his eyes are glowing red. And he says, put them back on. And it just, I love that. I don't know. It's basically he's Superman, but he's got an inferiority complex.
Yeah.
What the heck? That's great.
He's a very odd and interesting and complex character, considering he's basically just a guy that punches things.
Yeah. And he started out as an industrial spy who got superpowers.
What a strange character.
And then died and came back. And my gosh, it's great.
Well, one thing about the Avengers, and probably about Marvel in general, is what makes the characters compelling is not their powers. He can only fly and punch things.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he a good character? Well, because it's never about the powers. It's about the personalities, how they're written, it's their interaction with the other characters. And maybe that's why a team book's more appealing to me than a solo book, is you're going to get more interaction because you've got more characters there. Why do I like Wonder Man? It's not because he can fly and punch things. It's because his brain patterns, you know, were used to help make the Vision. He's the brother of the Grim Reaper, and then you know, so all this, and you start going out from there, and you got all the family connections. So it just kind of draws you into the Avengers web, I guess, a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go back and add a couple more since you guys came up with more than one. I'm a huge Iron Man fan, but right below that, you know, I've always said it's frustrating for me that of my three favorite Marvel characters, one of them is deader than Bucky, obviously, because Bucky's alive, deader than anybody but Uncle Ben, and two of them are alcoholics. But besides Iron Man, my two favorites are Mar-Vell, Captain Marvel, and Ms. Marvel, Carol Danvers. And, it's been a very checkered path for those three over the years, man. They've had their issues, all three of them. I like the cosmic stuff, the sci-fi angle to it. And so, you know, each of them kind of has that aspect. You know, with Iron Man, it's the technology and everything, and with the other two, it's the outer space connection and the Kree connection and all that. So I'm really stunned and very excited that that's kind of the direction that the Marvel Cinematic Universe seems to be going, is that they really are pushing the whole... I never would have dreamed, but I guess, you know, the cosmic angle is what they would go with, but... You know, as we've talked about on this show several times in the past, with different guests, and it's kind of like that's what they had really to work with. When you lose the X-Men, the Fantastic Four, and Spider-Man, the biggest chunk of the Marvel Universe that's really left for you to work around with is kind of the cosmic side of it, and they're making that work. So I never would have dreamed.
Yeah, and also, you know, maybe the general public's really finding out for the first time exactly how cool some of the stories in these comics can be. You know, it's not it's not always about Spider-Man punching the Green Goblin. You know, sometimes you get things like Thanos and the Guardians of the Galaxy and you know, huge cosmic things going on.
Yeah. So, well, what about villains? Let's talk about your favorite one, two, three, whatever, and who. But specify who's your favorite villain. Let me start with David this time.
Oh my goodness, gonna put me on the spot. well, the interesting thing about the Avengers, and as long a history as they have, and as much as a fan as I am of them, they don't have a real long list
of
iconic arch enemies. And I think the primary problem with coming up with a nice rogues gallery for them is the fact that they, number one, they're a team, but they are a team whose lineup is constantly changing.
That's
so
true.
How do you have a bad guy who's going to be motivated to beat this team when it can't really be anything personal against any of the members because, you know, the next day they might not be a member of that team?
I don't know. I counter that with the Grim Reaper.
Well, that's the, look, all right, hold on. Hold this for just a second. Let me explain. For those that don't know, the Avengers, I always like to say the Avengers have several different family trees kind of blended together, different wings of the mansion, so to speak. And there's the Pym family tree, which is Hank and Jan. Also, it leads you to Ultron.
Right.
Yep.
And sometimes they're connected. There's the Vision, Scarlet Witch getting married. Wonder Man is there. That branch. There's different interconnected branches that sometimes touch each other and sometimes don't. Okay, so pick back up.
Yeah,
okay,
sorry.
So I think that's why it's kind of hard to have a good archenemy for a team because the lineup's always changing. You know, how do you make a guy or a bad guy team want to face off or end up facing off against this other team all the time? I don't know. It's hard to do. Obviously, you know, I won't try to run down the list because it's a short list. I'll let y'all get to it. But you mentioned Ultron already. He's compelling. Not because he's like so powerful that you really are scared that there's going to be no way to actually beat him this time.
And see, he has connections to both of those two branches.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's what
makes him compelling because you actually have a personal stake in the some of the most important members of the Avengers.
That's
so
right.
So it's hard to find a personal stake, and the Ultron fits that bill. So you know. Kind of have to say Ultron. I'm trying right now to think of, you know, bad guy teams they've gone up against. Obviously, they've had the Masters of Evil. There's been like the Legion of Unliving or something like that. You've had the
Lethal Legion.
You've had the Proctor and the Gatherers. But, you know, but even like Masters of Evil, every time they face them, the lineup's a little bit different. So, I can point to favorite storylines where the villains were very compelling, but as far as a recurring arch enemy, I don't know if you can get better than Ultron.
My vote would be for Kang.
Okay.
Kang has that weird quality of he's always different each time because who knows what timeline he's from? If he's the original, is he timeline number 5 million? Who knows? But he always has some big scheme that seems to be earth-shattering. I think the thing for me with the Masters of Evil, looking back, pulling back and seeing where they fit in early on, I think it was kind of an obvious, hey, these are the villains. They need to team up like the good guys.
Right.
They need to fight each other. And I think early on, Stan realized this isn't kind of the way it needs to be because in my eyes, it sort of cheapens the quality of the Avengers to say, oh, they're just a bunch of singular people fighting their singular villains and maybe they swap and help take each other out. Whatever. I think when you look at the Avengers, if you want to make them high quality as a writer and a creator, you want to make them go up against the biggest threat. And that kind of ties in directly to the movie, this cosmic multi-world global threat and it's us four or five who are going to stop it. Oh, God, how's that going to work? It builds the tension, and it really kicks it up. And, yeah, we really can do that because we're the Avengers. I think that's why there have been few teams they fought to great effect, with the exception, in my mind, of the 80s Masters of Evil Mansion Siege.
Right.
Which was just incredibly good. But, you know, beyond that, Kang, Ultron, of course, Michael, Korvac, you know, those are the big ones. Thanos. Yeah, Kang would be mine.
All right. Let me break that.
And I was going to say, Steve Englehart just did some great stuff with Kang in the 70s.
Yeah.
Really used him to good effect. And I don't, you know, if that's everybody needs to read those issues. And yeah. I don't think Kang was done as well again until Kurt Busiek got a hold of him.
Right. Yep.
And with both Avengers Forever and the Kang Dynasty, which really
yeah.
is underrated. More people need to know about that story.
That's yep. exactly right. Well, I'm going to break down kind of the ones that you guys mentioned, and this is kind of my feelings on it. I think that you're exactly right about the it needs it, for the most part, with a couple of exceptions, you need that family connection that gives you a greater reason than just let's go fight this bad guy. This bad guy's attacking the Avengers. There needs to be that, you know, family connection that gives the Grim Reaper a good connection to them, because yeah. he's, like you said, he's Wonder Man's brother and he's tied into Ultron eventually and all that kind of thing. So he's actually among the minor Avengers villains. I think he's pretty good. But yeah, that definitely puts Ultron up there. I mean, Ultron is probably my favorite Avengers villain in some ways because A, it was the first comic book I ever read, and he was the bad guy and he scared me to death. And, he's so much better than the average robot villain. You know, I've always said Ultron is not so much a robot as like a demonic force in a metal body. That he makes a lot more sense as a character if you think of him that way. He's almost more like a Doctor Strange, you know, like Dormammu type villain inside an indestructible body than he is just a robot. Because just a robot's boring, but Ultron is calling people names. Ultron is cussing. Robots don't cuss.
He's got daddy issues.
Ultron is just nasty.
I mean, it's all about the Oedipus complex with him. I mean, he's always going after Pym. But I mean, to then create his bride based on Jan and to call the bride Jocasta. It all gets kind of creepy.
Just hang us a picture here, Ultron. Don't leave anything to the imagination. Just leave it all out for us stupid humans. But on the other hand, I think that that there are villains that are good for the Avengers as a it's very rare, but good for the Avengers as a team that don't necessarily have that family connection. And I think Kang and Thanos are the two big ones that they neither one of them really has. I mean, they've manufactured some stuff retroactively over the years, but not much. But Kang and Thanos have no real connection to the Avengers other than just fighting them a lot. And I like that. And it's Thanos for me, obviously he's, in some ways, he's Marvel's dark side, you know. In other words, the dark side character from the New Gods in DC, Thanos has no connection to the Avengers. He was a cosmic villain fighting Warlock, you know.
Right.
But he's just too good and too powerful a villain not to become an Avengers villain. Just like Darkseid was not a Justice League villain, but he was just too good and too powerful a villain not to make a Justice League villain out of him. So right. Thanos and Darkseid both started out as in little niches, being villains in little corners of their respective universes, but were both so effective as villains that they had to be brought over to become bigger villains in the main, you know, universe. And
but you know, there's not a lot of history of the Avengers and Thanos facing off against each other. They had one really good, really memorable, huge story, and then there was also, like, I think it was issue 125, where it crossed over with Captain Marvel, and you got Thanos on the very last page. Yeah. But you know, if you're looking through the history of the published Avengers comics at the best recurring villains, Thanos, you can't really consider him just because he doesn't really recur.
No. Yeah, there's really like four, I think, as far as I can think of, four major Thanos Avengers instances. First, there was the Cosmic Cube thing where everybody aged and he ended up floating in space when Mar-Vell shattered the Cosmic Cube. The second was the Avengers Annual number 7, Marvel 2-in-1 Annual number 2, which doesn't really have a name, but it's the one where Thanos tried to blow up all the stars to the first time he was trying to make Death happy. And that's where Warlock died first. The third one was probably the Infinity Gauntlet, Infinity War, where the Avengers played a major role. It was almost like the Secret Wars or something where they are there along with a bunch of other characters, but they were a major leading force. And when Captain America's there, he's always going to be kind of in charge.
Yeah, Infinity Gauntlet's fantastic. I mean,
yep. And then the fourth one was this Infinity thing that's just happened in the last couple of years that Jonathan Hickman wrote that I just read over the last few weeks. Which is very much of the mold of the current comics, and we'll touch on that at the end.
But also driven maybe by the what's going on
in the movies.
So we're going to see Thanos recur more now in the comics. Yeah. But you know, we're talking about looking, you know, at everything prior to the movie universe debuting.
Yeah.
You know, I think you know you have to look at that differently.
I think the movie universe is trying to make Thanos the Avengers villain, and they're really succeeding at that. So that's it. But about Kang, he's not a villain of any one specific Avenger. He is an Avengers villain. He doesn't really have, I mean, I know there's some thin connections to Fantastic Four. I was actually debating with a guy on Facebook last week who said that they couldn't use Kang in an Avengers movie because he's a Fantastic Four villain. I'm like, that's ridiculous.
That is ridiculous.
I mean, I know he has this sort of retconned connection to the Richards family or something.
Yeah.
Or to Doctor Doom. But that's all very tenuous. Always been an Avengers villain.
Well, the trick is to, again, have a reason for the villain to want to oppose a team called the Avengers when the lineup is always changing. And for Kang, he is a conqueror of the timeline. He's from the future, and he knows his history. And his motivation against the Avengers is that the Avengers have proven to be historically significant and a force for good in the universe, and he knows if he's going to conquer the 20th century or the 21st century, he's going to have to go take care of these guys. And so because he's got the perspective of a historical perspective on things, he knows this is the team he has to go after. So
that's right.
There's your motivation for going after that team.
And then, too, I guess there's also that I've always kind of seen Kang as the Ernest Hemingway of villains in the Marvel Universe.
Okay.
You know, he's looking for that big, I've got to go out and conquer. I'm manly. I'm, you know, it's boring here now that I've conquered everything. And some of those are variants of other Kangs and other timelines, I guess. I think Kurt Busiek did that really well in the Avengers Forever series, where Kang was tired. Kang had seen it all, but he still had that drive to be the best and to be the conqueror that his reputation has. I think that plays a big part of it, too, this early on in the Kirby and Lee stuff, you see, you know, I'm Kang, I'm, you know, all this stuff. And he does seem like he's headed out for his safari in a previous time to prove his status and stuff too.
Yeah, he is a fascinating character. And I think it in his perspective, it's a compliment to the Avengers that he kind of goes after them.
Yeah.
Because it verifies their status as Kurt once said, the varsity. The Avengers are the varsity, you know, the number one, the first string, basically, of the superheroes. So,
you never see him be more like a conqueror than in Kurt Busiek's stories.
Yeah,
right.
Both Avengers Forever and especially Kang Dynasty, you get to see what it means to be a conqueror.
And you're right that he has appeared in different molds over the years. Like, I mean, if you read David Michelinie's The Man Who Stole Tomorrow, he's completely different. He's a lunatic, basically. Yep. He's crazy. And here's the other thing that's interesting about Kang to me is why Ultron really started out in the first. And it was a long time before I became a Kang fan is because, as you said, David, Kang had his big appearance under who was it in like the 130s, 140s issues? Was it Englehart? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Englehart.
And I came in 162. And so basically Kang had his magnum opus of the 70s. Ended like a year or so before I started reading, and you didn't get any more Kang until Roger Stern in the mid 80s.
Yeah,
that's true.
There was like a 10-year period. And that was the 10 years I was actually reading Marvel Comics. And so I came in right after he was done for a decade, and yeah. I left right before he came back. So uh-huh. I really didn't read a Kang story other than David's book until probably going back in the 90s and getting the back issues of both Englehart and Stern's famous storylines. And then, of course, Kurt came along with his take, you know, pretty soon after that. So, yeah, I came to Kang fandom much later just because of circumstances. But I find it fascinating that we've had Ronan as a major movie villain and we haven't seen Kang yet.
Yeah.
Do you think we'll get a Kang movie or a movie with Kang in it somehow?
I would hope so, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to imagine it right now. You know, I think if they can just keep making Avengers movies long enough, I think we can get to it. But I don't know how you. I'd love to see it.
I guess he'd have to be one of the first couple of villains you use after they reboot in like 10 years, right? Because we already know what's pretty much coming through the rest of this current existence of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, yeah. I would think at some point, you know, after 2019 now, after the Infinity War movies and everything,
yeah,
at some point you're going to have to reboot, right? These actors are going to get too old, or they're going to not renew their contracts. And are you going to just have legacy heroes and have somebody besides Steve Rogers, somebody besides Tony Stark, or are you just going to keep the story going and just switch out the actors and pretend nobody notices?
Are you going to
start over?
Oh, see, this is how it's going to play out, and we can record it now and say it's going to happen, and then they can pay us royalties later. Thanos destroys the universe, and at the last second, Kang shows up.
Ooh.
And everything's different.
I like it.
The timeline was destroyed, but we can revive it.
It works for me.
Well, certainly bringing in a time traveler can help, justify, you know, inside the story, right, having new actors playing parts.
Kind of like Star Trek did.
Yeah.
And what Days of Future Past did.
Yeah.
As long as they don't bring in Teen Tony, I'm okay with it.
Oh, God. Let's not even go there. Bug Jan, Teen Tony. No Bug Jan, Teen Tony. Yeah, I think, you know, it's kind of like when they rebooted Spider-Man, you finally got the Lizard.
Yeah.
I think similarly, when they reboot Avengers in the 2020s, you'll get Kang and maybe Masters of Evil or Zodiac or something. You get around to the ones that they haven't used yet. So,
yeah, I mean, aren't they just going to keep making Avengers movies forever? I mean, why would they ever stop?
Would they stop?
Exactly. Yeah. So I think, obviously he's near the list of iconic Avengers villains. So as long as the rights are held by Marvel Studios, I don't know why they wouldn't eventually, but it's just hard to, for me, it's hard for my mind to go past 2019 right now.
Oh, yeah.
I just don't understand why more movie franchises don't just do what the James Bond movies do, which is just do them every 2 or 3 years and have them, you know, kind of connected and kind of not, and change out the actors as you need to and just ignore it and act like nothing happened and just keep cranking them out. I mean, are they allergic to money? If they just kept, they could just keep making, you know, they're kind of going to do that with Spider-Man now.
Yeah, wouldn't that be effectively just reboot whenever you want to, just don't do an origin story?
Yeah, exactly.
I think for some of the most major heroes we have here, we don't need origin stories. The origin stories, I think, are to kind of bring a mainstream audience along to kind of help them buy into the whole superhero concept.
Yeah.
But the audience is there now.
We're past that, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
America or the world, the movie-going audience, they accept superheroes. So I don't think we need origin stories.
That's exactly it. But, you know, I've said this before on this show, and some of the listeners know this, that I think that the reason that you keep getting origin stories in movies of superhero characters is because that's the story that movie people get. Because every superhero character has an origin story and then just ongoing adventures. But the origin story is the one where they start out one way, they learn a lesson, Uncle Ben is killed or whatever, they get their powers, they change their personality and become somebody new. They had that character transformation arc. Every other story is just, and then they fight this villain, and then they fight this villain, then they fight this villain. James Bond said, screw that. He fights this villain, he fights this villain, he fights this villain. There was never a James Bond origin story.
Yep.
So,
are you there? You're cutting out on me. Okay.
Yeah, you cut out on me too.
Well, the people listening on the audio are hearing me primarily because I'm recording it. So we'll be fine. They won't even know anything happened except for that. So, all right. So that's very good villain stuff. Now, the other major topic real quickly I want to get into is favorite storylines. So, okay. Kel, favorite storyline.
Oh, wow. Gosh, you know, when I was at my peak of reading Avengers, it was, early on at least, it was all the stuff leading up to number 200. When Marcus arrived and Ms. Marvel was later controversially, taken out of the picture. That era is one of my favorites, but I guess the best storyline ever for me, it's up there together. Busick's Avengers Forever and the Masters of Evil storyline, the Mansion Siege by Stern. Mm-hmm. Those are just two of the really good, resounding stories for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, something about the Mansion Siege story that it was probably one of the most gut-wrenching, like, emotional scenes I've ever read in a comic. Comics usually don't affect me emotionally. This one, as I'm thinking about it right now, I'm getting goosebumps because I had just read the Roger Stern, John Byrne, Captain America issues. Yeah. And in those issues in his solo book, you see Steve Rogers' Foot Locker. Yeah. You see his autographed baseball from Babe Ruth or Lou Gehrig. You see his only surviving photograph of his mother. And over in Avengers a couple years later, Roger Stern again writing the Under Siege story, and the bad guys, you know, have a coordinated attack. They take over the mansion and they break into Steve Rogers. He's tied up and they force him to watch as he breaks open the Foot Locker, tears the photograph in two.
Yep.
And takes the baseball apart, unravels it, and all of these things that he had from his childhood are just torn apart right in front of him.
Yep.
And I was just like, ugh, because I had the context of the Captain America issues, and it just like punched me right in the gut. Mm. Like, wow.
Yeah.
But that was that issue. That story is awesome because you finally had the villains acting smart.
Yep.
Instead of just bickering with each other, you had a guy with a plan, and they went about coordinating it, and it was just scary how effective it was. And it's like it was again a compelling story where the villains take center stage, and it led directly into another great little run where a war on Olympus, where they have to go fight the Greek gods.
So Hercules.
So I mean, and this was Roger Stern is like a good 5-6 issue arc that leads organically right into the next 5-6 issue arc, and he was just like he'd been on the book for about 5 years now, and it was just getting better and better, and that's right when he left. But not entirely his choice, but that was good stuff. Yeah. Now, obviously, when you're listing favorite stories, that's got to go right up there. You have to look, to me, the Avengers became the Avengers, not when Captain America joined in number 4, not when the founders left and the Kooky Quartet came in with 16. That was astounding. That was amazing because you had X-Men and Fantastic Four static teams, and the Avengers were a static team. This was the Avengers. There was no reason to think it was anybody else. Mm-hmm. And they all leave, number 16, and a whole new group. That changed what comic teams could be about. But the Avengers became the Avengers when Hank and Jan returned. Mm. It was like, oh, it's not just that we changed. It's that they can come back if they want to. Now we have a larger cast, a revolving door. So it was late in the Stan Lee run, like around issue 28 or so, when Hank and Jan came back. Their return to me officially like set the tone and the direction for the Avengers, because now you had a revolving door cast. So I think that's a significant issue that gets overlooked by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Roy Thomas came on, and Roy Thomas had a fantastic run. And he did all he introduced the Vision, all the stuff with Yellow Jacket and Hank and Jan getting married, all the stuff that happened right around there, and then of course you got the Kree-Skrull War, and you've got to put the Kree-Skrull War up there with all time best stories.
Yep.
It was groundbreaking for Marvel. This thing ran I think over a year, nothing like that had ever happened in comics before. It was this huge sprawling epic scope of a story. And put the Avengers right in the middle of this intergalactic war is just amazing. So you got the Kree-Skrull War still holds up today, although Roy Thomas kind of indulged himself toward the end and just had all his favorite Golden Age heroes explode out of Rick Jones' mind. It was kind of random. Don't know how that works, but still an awesome, awesome story. Then you've got the Celestial Madonna saga with Steve Englehart. I think she ends up marrying a tree at the end. If I'm not mistaken. All the Kang stuff that Englehart did, and you get into the Shooter McElhinney stuff. I mean, the Count Nefaria trilogy, the Korvac saga, which brought in the real Guardians of the Galaxy. All that stuff. All these are the highlights of the series. They're all my favorite stories now. But I came up in the 80s. So I'm a fan of – this is the first story. You know, this is my earliest experience with the book. The fall and redemption of Hank Pym, which began with his court-martial. I guess it was in issue 213 or so. And, of course, the famous scene with Jan shortly after that. And then it culminates, I think, in either 229 or 230, and where he ends up spending time in jail. He's going to court. The bad guys break him out of the courthouse, which made him look more guilty.
Yeah, really.
He didn't know they were going to do that. That storyline is one of my favorites. And then if you've got...
That was, by the way, just excruciating for me. I barely got through that. I just couldn't. I couldn't take it. It was just so grim, depressing.
Yeah. So I also, you know, I'm a huge fan of the Black Knight and Proctor story that Bob Harris did, and I'm also a fan of the Kurt Busiek run. But if I had to pick a specific story from him, it would have to be Avengers Forever and Kang Dynasty, and then also his Ultron story. The Ultron Unlimited, I think.
Well, I think you pretty much named every major storyline ever.
To me, when you talk Avengers history, you take those handful of stories and you hold it up. You hold it up against anything.
Sure. I guess I'll just name a couple. I agree that the stuff that Kurt Busiek did in the late 90s, early zeros is absolutely fantastic and classic, but I came to it as a much older person, and so it didn't have that same, you know, resonance down to my soul that the stuff when you're a little kid does. So
right.
I think for me, it's always going to be two things. One is basically the whole first Shooter run, because, I mean, you start out with Graviton and the Grim Reaper and then you go into the Bride of Ultron and the Crazy Ant-Man. Then you go straight from there into a nice Lethal Legion / Super Nefaria story, which was awesome. And then you get that year-long Korvac saga, which includes the return of Ultron and finishing him off. So basically from Avengers 158 to 177, if you take the fill-in, there was a couple of fill-in issues, 163, I think, and 169. But if you take those out pretty much... And I like 163 because it's Iron Man single-handedly beating up all the champions, which is cool. But if you take that 158 to 177 run, that is just, to me, you can't touch it. Now, for a single story, that Jim Starlin Avengers Annual number 7, Marvel 2-1 Annual number 2, I've always said that is my favorite comic book story ever because it's concise. It's just two issues. But it has so much mind-blowing. I mean, you've got Warlock and the Soul Gem and all of his villains down in there with him and Gamora. You've got Thanos. You've got the danger to the universe getting blown out by Thanos when we first discover he's a total nihilist and worshiper of – a freaking nihilist, man, and worshiper of death. You get the Avengers and Captain Marvel teaming up. You get Spider-Man and the Thing coming in to save the day. And you discover that the only reason Spider-Man exists is to free free Warlock so he can kill Thanos the first time, which I thought was kind of cool. So those are my two probably favorites. I wanted to mention, since talking about there was something you said a minute ago that made me think of this. Maybe it was that when you mentioned that that Mantis married a tree, I thought maybe that's where Groot came from. Yeah. But
they're just making everybody comfortable, and it's okay to marry a tree.
That's right. So, but did you hear that? I just heard this yesterday that the Guardians of the Galaxy script actually has been nominated for a Screenwriters Guild Award.
Holy crap.
As adapted screenplay, which means they're crediting Abnett's Guardians of the Galaxy comic books as the original source for an adapted screenplay. How awesome is that? That's the world we live in today, gentlemen.
That's pretty
amazing. And that's something I was hoping we would get to. One of the things that's been just so crazy about where things have come in the last 20 years, I've had this conversation multiple times with my daughter, who has always had these awesome movies pretty much whenever she wanted to watch them. And she looks at me like, why are you so excited about that? And it's, you don't understand the fact that we're talking about people that I read about as a kid. I never imagined when I was 10 that I would see this on the big screen and that people would love it.
No, we were seeing crap on the big screen and the little screen.
Well, not only that, but even as comic book fans, as Avengers fans, in the late 80s, early 90s, we were being made fun of by other comic book fans.
Yes.
All the X-Men people ruled the world.
Because all the X-Men and Spider-Man people thought they were cool.
Oh, yeah. did you think that we would live in a world where Iron Man is the most popular superhero, the Avengers franchises are dominating, and this is the pièce de résistance, Marvel is intentionally minimizing the X-Men?
Yes.
That blows my mind. Marvel's like, we are the Avengers company. X-Men, I may have heard of them.
Exactly.
That's just unbelievable.
It is crazy.
Yeah. And so, you know, and I don't know. It's just one of those weird things where you pinch yourself. And am I really seeing this?
And it's not just that you have Rocket Raccoon and Groot in the highest grossing movie of the year. It's that it's a movie that has Glenn Close in it.
Yes.
Winter Soldier has Robert Redford in it.
Yes.
Thor the Dark World has Anthony Hopkins
in it.
Ant-Man has Michael Douglas in it.
And you know, Robert Downey Jr. has been nominated for Academy Awards in the past. And it's just and you've got Ant-Man flying on an ant.
I know. Yes. He's on a flying ant. I'm just like, oh my gosh. I thought that seeing, you know, Ronan and Groot and Rocket Raccoon. But I never thought I'd see Ant-Man actually on an ant, but we do. Well, you know, mark my words, in 10 years, people will be talking about the Inhumans the way they talk about the X-Men right now. Marvel has a strategy, I think, which is to minimize the X-Men as long as they don't control the movies. And they're going to make the Inhumans into what the X-Men have been for the last 20 or 30 years. And there's going to come a point where Fox can't make any money off the X-Men because everybody's like, oh, Inhumans are awesome. Who are the X-Men? And I never thought I'd see that day, but I think that's going to happen.
Well, a couple of things happened here. I think it's the timing of special effects technology worked out well for Avenger fans.
Yes.
Because absolutely. You're talking about how the old TV shows and movies, you know, the old 50s Superman, the Linda Carter Wonder Woman, all these things that we were superhero fans. We knew how cool the comics were, and we turned to the movie or the TV shows, and they kind of fell flat. And it's like, no, really, the comics are cool. Really, I know this is lame. Really, well,
Exhibit One: Thor and Daredevil from the Hulk movie.
Yeah.
So what happened was, you know, they started getting a budget, started getting special effects, X-Men movie, Spider-Man movie. Mm. Marvel licensed out their top properties because they weren't a movie studio and they were kind of bankrupt and they needed money. And it was a good move for them. They take their top properties, get them out there. They're making lots of money, infuses the company with cash. Meanwhile, special effects technology keeps getting better. Mm-hmm. And they're in a position to make their own movies. They've licensed out this other stuff. So at the point where special effects really kind of fully came to its own to be able to do justice to the type of superhero stories we like, mm-hmm. at that, by the time it got there, all Marvel had left were the group of characters that you and I want to see the most.
That's right. They cleared all the chaff out of the way and opened it up.
And what happens when comic book people are the ones making the comic book movie? The movies are really good.
Absolutely.
And they get the tone right. And so now you've got this juggernaut in Hollywood, and it's attracting the highest levels of acting talent, and you've got and everybody else is trying to catch up and figure out what they're doing right.
Yeah. Well, and you know, one of the things I predict talking about, you know, oh, who are the X-Men? I predict at some point they're going to make enough money where they're going to say we're taking it back, and Disney's lawyers will acquire them. I mean, it's just exactly.
With all the Infinity Stones in play, if they can get the rights to the characters, they can easily bring in some of these other, you know, X-Men movie casts and not have it disrupt the continuity of the Marvel.
They'll have Spider-Man. They're already negotiating now to get Spider-Man into the Marvel stuff. And I guarantee you, when this Fantastic Four movie tanks, the Fantastic Four will be back in the Marvel fold within 2 years.
Yeah.
The X-Men are going to hold out a little bit longer, but I think the Inhumans are going to put the last stake through their heart. So it's going to fall like dominoes, and pretty soon Marvel's going to have it all back. But you make a great point, David, that it's for us, it's good that it worked out this way, because we would have gotten all kinds of Marvel, X-Men, and Fantastic Four movies, I think, and the Avengers would have been like third or fourth shrift, whereas now they are driving the bus, and Guardians of the Galaxy is like second place, you know, in there, which we never would have gotten. Never would have gone that way. So, all right, we're in our last couple of minutes here. Any concluding thoughts about the Avengers and kind of where they are today and anything like that? Kel, what do you think? Last thoughts about the Avengers?
Gosh. I just think we live in the golden age. and for those who are not, and I can't imagine there are any comics fans, non-comics fans listening to this, but, you know, maybe so. If you're not a comics fan, you know, the golden age we talk about is comics fans being, you know, way back when, you know, it all started with, you know, Marvel Mystery Comics and all that then during World War II and maybe prior to it. This is our golden age for movies. We are seeing movies that will inform, I think, comics entertainment for a long time. I mean, it's already kind of spilling over into TV with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Agent Carter, and then the Netflix stuff that's coming. I mean, Daredevil, The Defenders, what? I mean, it's just going to grow from there, I think.
Yeah.
You know, at some point it may reach saturation level, but I'll watch it all and enjoy it the whole way through.
Yeah, absolutely. David?
Well, for me, the irony is we are in the golden age of these movies, and I love these movies, but this all exploded right about the time that I finally, once and for all, had to give up on the comics.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. I just was not a fan of anything Brian Michael Bendis did with the series. Yes. I stuck with it a little bit until the issue early on in New Avengers where it was like 8 consecutive silent splash pages.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? I don't need this. And it didn't resemble anything that I spent my whole life reading. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm glad they did a little finale issue at the end of that disassembled storyline. Because as far as I'm concerned, that's the period on the end of the sentence. And I love all the comics up until then for the most part. But I am disconnected from what's happened with the comics since then. I have no real desire to dig into it. But I'm familiar enough with the characters and the history and can appreciate, you know, the kind of history of Marvel adaptations in the past that, of course, I'm just riding high on all these movies and TV shows. It's fantastic. It's fun. It's exciting. I want to also give special mention to the first Earth's Mightiest Heroes animated series.
Oh, yeah. That's a good series. That's right.
That more than the movies, that series captured that Avengers spirit that made me excited reading those books as a kid. That show right there can turn a lot of people onto the comics if they'll give it a chance.
Absolutely.
And one final word, when we were mentioning favorite characters, I forgot Hercules. Hercules is a favorite of mine because of how he's kind of written as kind of this clumsy, well-meaning college frat guy, you know, with it's all brawn and no brain.
Right.
Come, let us enjoy this. Yeah.
His solo series, The Incredible Herc, that was written by Greg Pak and Fred Van Lent, is just like the perfect take on the character. Tons of fun. It is a fun comic. It takes about 6 or 7 trade paperbacks. I recommend it to everybody.
That's awesome.
And if I can have one final word, actually 2 words. Two Gun Kid, Red Wing, Joe Crow, hope you're satisfied.
All right, gentlemen, we are out of time. I know we've all got things to go off and do now, so I'm gonna I'll do a few concluding remarks here, but I'll let you guys go ahead and run. And it was great to have you on. I had a lot of fun. I know the listeners are going to have a good time listening to this. And I guess all we can really say to conclude it is Avengers Assemble.
Avengers Assemble. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Many thanks to Kel Carpenter and David Wright for joining the show today to talk about AvengersAssemble.net, our anniversary, and about the Avengers. I thought that was a really cool conversation, and I was glad they were able to come aboard. Don't forget to check out David's new novel, My Brother's Keeper, which is a sort of fantasy adventure story with very strong spiritual themes that run through it. We talked about it on episode, I believe, 52 of this show just a few weeks ago. And also, of course, visit www.whiterocketbooks.com. You'll find many of my books there that are published by White Rocket, including if you like the Avengers and you don't know it already, and I think that many of the people who listen to the show or know me know this, but and I mentioned it during the show, that I am the author of the superhero novel series The Sentinels, which are absolutely heavily influenced by my love for the Avengers. And we have done 7 novels and 1 anthology so far, and I'm actually writing the 8th novel currently. They come out in they're set in sort of trilogies, where the first trilogy was Sentinels, Wind Strikes, the Warlord, A Distant Star, and Apocalypse Rising, which was the origin of the team, and they face sort of Red Skull and Kang type villains. And then the second trilogy, and that trilogy, that first trilogy was called The Grand Design overall. The second trilogy overall is called The Rivals, and it is comprised of Volume 4, The Shiva Advent, Volume 5, World Mind, and Volume 6, Stellarax. And it is much more the Celestials, Galactus-level threat that the Sentinels have to face. And then in Volume 7, beginning the third trilogy, which came out a couple of years ago, it's called Metal God, and begins sort of what I would think of. It's got sort of 2 parallel plot lines running at the same time. Half the team is on Earth, involved in kind of trying to recruit new members and facing threats on Earth, and the other half of the team are scattered out in outer space in sort of what I would think of as like a Shi'ar Kree Star Jammers, you know, when the X-Men go off into space and deal with the big galactic empires type thing, sort of that sort of storyline. And it's called Order Above All is the name of that storyline. And I'm currently writing Volume 8, which is called The Dark Crusade. So be sure to check out those books. If you get the paperbacks, they're illustrated by Chris Kohler. It's also on Kindle. And as I mentioned earlier, my co-plotter on that series is Bobby Polite. So check out The Sentinels if you like original superhero action adventure with more depth than you'd get in the average comic book, because they're novels, so you can get more deeply into the story. And they are very, very heavily influenced by all those great Avengers stories that Kel and David and I were just talking about, as well as by many other movies and comics and books that you probably enjoy just as much as I do. So The Sentinels from White Rocket Books. And of course, also my space opera series that includes Lucian, Dark God's Homecoming, Hawk, Hand of the Machine, and the shattering trilogy, Legion 1, Lords of Fire, Legion 2, Sons of Terra, Legion 3, Kings of Oblivion. In fact, our next episode, I believe, I'll be doing an audiobook special with the beginning of Sons of Terra. So, once again, it's time for the rocket to get on out of here. Thanks once again to David and Kel for coming on board. I hope that you enjoyed that walk down memory lane with the Avengers and Avengers fandom. And we will see you all down the road.
Our world's about to break. Tormented and upset. Lost when we wait. No way to
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.